This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. At the end of each show, you hear me say, there's always more to the story. And today, we find out where some of those stories lead through a project we launched called Reveal's Reporting Network. More than 800 journalists have signed on. We provide each of them with data and reporting techniques so they can see how stories we've covered are playing out in their communities. Just after the Super Bowl last February, we brought you a story about concussions in high school sports. We focused in on Oregon, where reporter Lee Vandervoo had a simple question. How many high school athletes there get concussions?
We asked for 2 years of these records from all the public high schools in Oregon. That's 235 schools. And we looked at which sports had a lot of concussions at which schools, whether they had happened in big districts or small ones. And we also just wanted to see who was following the law.
Don't states enforce it?
Actually, no, there's no enforcement mechanism. So at minimum, we thought this could be a really good audit. Do people do this if nobody checks? At the end, it was really hard to be confident in how well the laws were being followed.
Every state has a law requiring the kids who bang up their heads playing sports in high school get taken out of games or practice. Many say a medical professional has to clear them before they can play again. Lee found that these laws are designed to prevent individual athletes from getting a second concussion. They're not set up to prevent concussions in the first place. Lee wanted to know what Oregon had learned after a decade of pulling kids out of games because of head injuries.
Our data showed something like 600 concussions or suspected concussions over 2 years at schools. That gave us enough good data to use.
600 knocked heads. Is that a lot?
Well, if you break it out, it's roughly 50 concussions per 1,000 athletes. So anecdotally, as the person who enters those in a spreadsheet one by one, I can tell you that sometimes it really looks like a lot. 5 per game, 4 per game.
Based on Lee's experience, we made a list of questions that anyone could ask to find out how their school handled head injuries. More than 150 people got on the list, including Michael DeJoanna in Colorado. He's a reporter with KUNC Public Radio.
I knew basically nothing. I don't cover sports. And if I've covered concussions at all, it's been through my military reporting.
Using our guide as a starting point, Michael started asking school districts how they handle concussions. Eventually, he met the mom whose son became the name and face of Colorado's concussion law. Michael takes the story from here.
I take my computer over to Kelly Jantz because she can't get an old video of her son to play.
Let's see, make sure we have sound.
I set my laptop on a crowded table. Kelly works in a hospital. We're in a small room there. She's taking a break to meet with me.
It's coming up. It says Jake's video. Let's see. This should be play.
The sentimental music makes Kelly smile. Photos of her son as a young teenager flash by.
Number 40, there he is right there.
Number 40, Jake Snakenberg, doing what he loved, playing football for Grandview High School in Aurora, Colorado.
There he goes.
Kelly hasn't seen this video in years, but she knows every beat. She leans in and adjusts her glasses as pictures move by. She's so totally focused on the small screen that she seems to forget that I'm there. Kelly's looking for something.
This is going to be it, I bet.
Her son barrels through defenders to score a touchdown. It's not the touchdown that Kelly's been waiting to see. It's the big grin on Jake's face, slightly hidden by his helmet, a mixture of humbleness and joy. This is always Jake Snakenberg, forever 14 years old. Some of these images are from the day he died in 2004.
I just miss it. It's hard because, I mean, he loved what he did. If we knew, if we'd just known, you know, but it just not.
If she'd just known more about concussions. In the week before his death, Jake had complained of tingling hands after a hit in a football game. It didn't seem serious, but it turned out to be. Apparently, his brain had been hurt, too. So when he got hit again in the next game, his brain swelled up so much that it killed him. This double concussion is called second impact syndrome, but Kelly had never heard of it, even though she's a nurse and her husband's a doctor. Back then, they knew football could be dangerous, just not this dangerous.
We didn't know then how great the consequences could be. We didn't have that information.
Kelly had no idea if this sort of thing was common. She didn't even know how often other high school athletes got concussions. And without that big picture information, looking back, she felt she couldn't make a good decision about whether to let her son play.
It's hard, you know. Would I have yanked him out of football? I don't know.
But she did know that something had to change so other kids wouldn't die playing high school sports. It took over 6 years. Kelly joined forces with school and sports officials and got the ear of then state senator Nancy Spence.
Jake Snakenberg was a constituent of mine, a student at Grandview High School. I didn't know him and I didn't know his family. But his mother came to me and asked me if I would be willing to carry the bill.
The Health and Human Services Committee will come to order.
In a packed state capitol hearing room in February of 2011, Kelly Jantz made her case. She told senators they could save lives by passing a law requiring coaches to pull young athletes out of play if they hurt their heads.
Setting a strict guideline for return to play sends the message to everyone, to coaches, parents, and the kids, that the consequences of a concussion must be taken seriously.
Support was widespread. Parents, players, coaches, even Joe Brown, a top NFL executive, and Billy Thompson, the former Denver Broncos defensive back, showed up. Senator Spence, a Republican, easily found allies in her own party.
The motion is for the adoption of Senate Bill 40. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed, no.
As well as among Democrats, all the way up to the governor, who signed it.
Senate Bill 40 passes.
Colorado's youth concussion law is similar to Oregon's and every other state's around the country. Athletes suspected of having a concussion must be pulled out of practice or competition. Almost every law says they can't return until a medical professional says it's okay in writing. Colorado's law goes further than many because it covers athletes as young as 11 in club and rec leagues, not just schools. The law passed with strong support, but not without a warning from then-state Senator Sean Mitchell, another Republican. He said there was no way to make sure the law would make a difference, no way to hold anyone accountable for safety.
This bill has no teeth. There's no enforcement provision. There's no penalty provision. There's not even a reporting provision.
No state laws like this require anyone to keep track of concussions. So like Lee found in Oregon, it's hard to be confident how well Colorado's law is being followed. I got on the phone with a guy who had helped shape the law back then.
Well, Bert, I appreciate you taking the time out.
Not a problem.
Bert Borgman lobbies for the Colorado High School Activities Association. We call it CHASA. They make the regulations for high school sports. He remembers the goal when writing the law was to ensure kids who got hurt stopped playing, not to count how many kids got hurt.
We were looking for the educational resources that we could provide to help get them into the appropriate treatments as necessary, you know, those kinds of things.
Under Colorado law, coaches get educated. They're required to take a concussion training course every year. But because there's no requirement that schools keep track of head injuries, it is almost impossible to see how that training translates to the field. How many kids get pulled from play? Which schools or teams have the most head injuries? Former Senator Spence says that would be a lot to ask.
And I don't think that there's a way you could trace that. Every coach of every sport of every kid from 11 to 18, it's difficult.
But we found a way to start using Reveal's pocket guide plus the Colorado Open Records Act. And I showed the senator what we found.
6,000 concussions?
6,000.
The records we got showed that Colorado students were pulled out of play for head injuries 6,000 times. That number spans the last 5 years. But the true number must be much higher because we only got good data from 6 school districts. That's 6 out of 178 districts in Colorado.
In the big school districts in rural, Metro Denver?
In 5 larger school districts. That would include Cherry Creek.
But it doesn't include Denver because Denver they wouldn't give you any data.
Denver is the largest district in the state. They told me that athletic trainers at each school have head injury information, but they don't track or report any injuries publicly. Other districts told us they don't even keep track of concussions. But every district we spoke to says it takes head injuries seriously. I show the data I have to Don Comstock, a national concussion guru.
Love it, love it, love it, love it, whenever anybody collects data.
Don's a researcher at the University of Colorado's School of Public Health. She runs a big database that analyzes youth sports head injuries collected from a sampling of schools around the country. The two of us are in my office, and we're squinting at tiny type on my computer screen.
Oh, let's see if I can back.
Can you scoot it over?
Skosh, there we go.
We find a way to zoom in. We're looking at a chart from one school district. It tallies up the number of times students were pulled with head injuries.
Oh, that's the school?
Yeah.
Okay, so school and year. Right.
So this would be Cherry Creek.
Cherry Creek Schools. It's one of the state's largest districts, and it's where Jake Snakenberg played football.
We see football here.
Yeah, that's what you'd expect. Football should be the big hairy beast that drives most of this.
Big hairy beast. In other words, football has the most head injuries that pulled kids out of games, 1/3 of the total in Cherry Creek. Schools don't decide whether a student has had a concussion. They leave that to medical professionals, and even then, it's both an art and a science. Football is not the only hairy beast that Don is checking.
Where's your girls' soccer?
It's boys' soccer, softball.
It's boys' soccer. So usually
girls' soccer right
there
here.
There you go.
So
we'd expect it to be just a little bit higher than boys' soccer, which it is, it looks like. Yeah. So that's pretty similar to what we'd expect.
Here's the thing about numbers. They have the power to make athletes safer. They can catch things coaches or players might never think of. Like at what age hitting the ball is safer in soccer, or how often football teams should have full contact practice. Don gets very detailed information from the high schools where she does research, like where on the court or field did the injury happen? Has this student had a similar injury before? What kind of drills does the coach regularly run?
We ask every single week, mm-hmm. How many days this week did mm-hmm. your coach have full contact drills? They should not have more than 3.
She found that concussion rates in football went down by 20% nationally after teams limited full contact practices, even though not all schools did it.
So if all the schools would follow the recommendation, the effectiveness of this intervention would be even bigger.
Wow. 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 It's amazing how epidemiology can help us.
We can do some fun things.
Don looks only at numbers aggregated from different high schools in different places. The 6,000 suspected concussions that I found all track back to specific Colorado school districts. But because each district collects different information, if any at all, we can't dig in like Don does. For example, we can't see whether coaches run drills that regularly put players at a high risk. Without good, consistent local numbers, Don says there just can't be real accountability.
Right now, because we don't have good enough data to really do school-to-school direct comparisons, I think that means that we need to avoid pointing blame at any individual school.
Don says state high school activities associations have the power to require schools to collect useful local data. In Colorado, again, that's CHASA.
CHASA needs to take accountability for either promoting recommendations or actually installing requirements for evidence-based interventions mm-hmm. that either have been proven to be effective or that have strong probability of being effective.
So what does CHASA think? I go to CHASA headquarters. It's a small building across from a condo complex in Aurora. I'm buzzed in through a security door.
Jen Roberts-Ulig.
Once inside, I meet Jen Roberts-Ulig, an assistant commissioner at CHASA. I ask her, should they require schools to track concussions? Should they do it in a way that would let people compare schools or coaches?
Would CHASA then advance or advise for a state law or of some sort, or make it a rule that from CHASA?
That's a great question.
CHASA,
I mean,
say you have to do this, and if you don't do this, you can't play.
I think before we could go down that road, we'd definitely have to make sure we have it very lined out what we're looking for.
She says a CHASA committee is starting to explore the idea. Right now, Colorado law makes students who might have a concussion stop playing until they're cleared by a medical professional. It doesn't try to measure how well that's working or find ways to lower the number of head injuries that happen or hold anyone accountable for doing either of those things. I take the records I dug up to Cherry Creek Schools. Larry Bull is the athletic director there. We calculated that about 3% of Cherry Creek's athletes were pulled out of play for head injuries each of the past 3 years. That's roughly similar to other Colorado districts with enough data to compare. But it's about 3 times as high as Michigan, the only state that collects and publishes comprehensive concussion numbers. The raw number is 721 head injuries in Cherry Creek over 3 years. I ask Larry Bull what he thinks about that.
Is that a lot to you? Does that sound like a lot?
It does. I would have to go. I don't have it memorized, but I would have to go back.
But he looks over all my paperwork and finally agrees the district's data is accurate.
No, that's probably right. Maybe I'm just shocked.
Shocked at the number of suspected concussions in his own district. In addition to the big hairy beast of football, almost 9% were in girls' soccer. More than 7% were in cheerleading. Even from the basic information Cherry Creek provided, I can see head injuries climbed steadily, up almost 12% in 3 years. Those calculations are simple. They didn't take me long to do. So why shouldn't Cherry Creek put these numbers out every year for parents, students, and anyone else to see?
Do you support the public release of
yes and no
data? Yes and no.
Yes.
Okay.
And no.
What is the yes and what?
We are not opposed to this data being public.
That's Abby Smith, who's also sitting at the table. She's the district's director of communications.
If the public wants to know, great. Put it out there. Come up with a form, put it out there, and make it something that everybody has. But I think there's what is going to be used with that data.
We're not opposed to publicly publishing that somehow, if that's some sort of state requirement or something that groups come to suggest would be a recommendation that would make kids safer.
They have no plans to do that now. But if you want to ask your school district for head injury numbers like I did, text HEAD to 474747. That's HEAD to 474747. We'll send you a short list to get you started, not just about numbers, but concussion policies. In Cherry Creek, athletic director Larry Bull says he's sure high school athletes are safer than they were a generation ago because of Jake Snakenberg's death on that football field in 2004.
Yes, the Snakenberg law has made a difference. 100% made a difference.
One big change, Bull says people are watching for concussions now. Anyone can step up and tell a school official they think a player has a head injury. Like many districts in the state, Cherry Creek follows a gradual return-to-play protocol so athletes have the time to heal. So on a freezing Friday night, I go to watch the last regular season Cherry Creek High School football game. They're playing Grandview, the team that Jake Snakenberg was on. The game looks a lot like that video I was watching with his mom, Kelly. Same white, blue, and black uniforms as 15 years ago. Same songs from the band. Same happy fans.
Good job, defense!
I don't see any brutal hits or anyone pulled out. But it's still tackle football. Kelly Jantz lost Jake in an ordinary game like this.
And I watched him take a pretty hard hit in warm-ups, like one that caught my attention. Then during the game, he lined up, you know, and he set, and then he fell forward. And he he was trying to get up, and you could tell something wasn't quite right, and he turned to come to the sideline, and he went down, and that was it.
Kelly says the Colorado law was an important change, but she wants more. 3 years ago, she took her son's story to Washington, D.C.
He cared for those in his life. He had a joy about him.
Kelly told a House committee gathering research on youth sports concussions that parents, schools, coaches, and students need comprehensive data. There's been a bill to do that, languishing in Congress since 2015. Kelly thinks numbers might eventually erase the disbelief she still runs into.
I still feel like there's a lot of, it doesn't happen that often. And, what happened to Jake? That's so rare. And, you know, there's still a culture out there to kind of butt up against.
Kelly was as surprised as anyone by the 6,000 head injuries we uncovered. But in that big number, she sees some good. 6,000 kids who were hurt, then pulled out of play to heal. She's glad of that.
It feels so good to know that maybe in those 6,000, maybe there are some kids who avoided long-term problems or suffering, ending up like Jake. God, that means the world to me.
Thanks to Michael DeJuana for bringing us that story. Michael is an investigative reporter at KUNC Public Radio in Greeley, Colorado. When we come back, our colleagues in Kentucky had a look at some data we put together on sexual assault, and they discovered a surprising story about how prosecutors and police in Louisville deal with rape cases.
How you doing?
Fine.
You care if I come in?
Sure.
What's going on? You here by yourself or somebody else in here with you?
There was like 5 or 6 officers, and I was really like nervous, like even open the door to them.
That's coming up next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between. And they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letton. Today, we're hearing stories that came out of Reveal's reporting network. That's when other news organizations follow up on our investigations in their own communities. Last year, we looked at whether police were really doing as well as they say they are when it comes to catching rapists. We found that in Austin, Texas, police were telling city officials that they were clearing lots of rape cases.
And we're fortunate that we do exceed the national averages on all categories.
That's Brian Manley back in 2016. At the time, he was Austin's assistant chief. He was telling the Public Safety Commission how well his department was doing when it came to clearing some serious crimes.
As you can see with the homicide, the rapes, all three categories of robberies lumped together.
Usually, police call a case cleared if they've solved a crime or arrested someone. But our reporting with Newsy and ProPublica found that many police departments were clearing rape cases without arresting anyone. They were using something called exceptional clearance. We asked Tom McDevitt to explain it. He's a former commander of the Sex Crimes Unit in Philadelphia.
An exceptional clearance means that you know the crime, you're able to prove a crime occurred. You have a victim. You know where the person is and who they are, the defendant. And either the prosecutor doesn't want to prosecute or the victim doesn't want to go forward with the case.
You'd use exceptional clearance if the suspect had left the country maybe or died. An official at the Department of Justice told us exceptional clearance is supposed to be used sparingly, but we found police using it again and again to clear sexual assault cases, and that made it look like they were getting a lot more rapists off the street than they really were. Reporter Eleanor Klibanoff used our data as a part of her investigation into how the Louisville, Kentucky Police Department handled sexual assault cases. Eleanor works for the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting at Louisville Public Media, and she joins me now.
Hey, Al.
Okay, so what did you and your colleagues find when you looked at Louisville's data?
So when that data first came out, my colleague Jacob Ryan and I noticed that Louisville had the sixth highest rate of rape cases being cleared by exception rather than by arrest. So we started looking into it a year ago, and almost immediately, when we asked the Louisville Metro Police for comment, their spokesperson, Jesse Halliday, challenged these findings.
The implication that you make when you phrase it that way is that we know who a bunch of rapists are and we choose not to prosecute them.
Is that what's happening in Louisville?
I mean, by clearing these cases by exception, they're saying they know who a lot of accused rapists are and they have probable cause to arrest them, but they're not. In Louisville, almost half of all rape cases are cleared by exception instead, generally because a prosecutor declined the case before an arrest was made.
Why would a prosecutor decline the case before the arrest was made?
Right. So Louisville police take every rape case to the prosecutor before they make an arrest. So the prosecutor gets to screen that case before the arrest is made. And what we found is that they often bring them these cases very early in the investigation. So the prosecutor declines the case, the police don't make an arrest, but they still get to clear the case by exception.
In your new podcast called Dig, you interview a woman who was already traumatized by a sexual assault, and when the police get involved, the investigation seems to go bad from the start.
Right, the case of Jen Sonato. She agreed to let us use her name in the story because she wants people to know what she's been through.
Let's hear that story now, but before we get started, we should warn listeners that it includes descriptions of sexual violence.
Jen Sonato lives in northern Indiana. She's 42 with three kids at home. She's a medical device rep. Back in January 2018, she came to Louisville to oversee a surgery involving one of the devices she sells. When she got into town, she met the surgeons at a steakhouse for dinner.
You just talk about the case, troubleshooting, who's going to do what the next day.
After dinner, Jen went back to the Marriott Hotel where she was staying. She stopped at the bar for a glass of wine. She opened her laptop to review the next day's surgical case when a guy started talking to her. She remembers going outside for a cigarette with him at one point. She remembers it tasting funny. She remembers him pushing the bartender to pour her more wine. And then she says she can't remember much. But she says when she came to, she was in her hotel room, and so was the man from the bar.
I was just screaming at him, what happened? What happened? Why is all this blood here? I mean, I'm panicking. And I just remember him putting khaki pants on and, like you've seen in the movies or something, literally running out the door.
It was 3 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday when Louisville Metro police officer Jeremy Wright arrived at the Marriott Hotel with five other officers, four men and one woman. Wright was wearing a body camera.
It's Paulie, it's open the door, please.
There was like five or six officers. And I was really like nervous, like even open the door to them.
How you doing?
Fine.
You care if I come in?
Sure.
What's going on? You here by yourself or somebody else in here with you?
No, maybe so.
So what's going on?
I just remember kind of like walking backwards, like, oh my God, why are they all coming in? And I was just, I remember speaking really quickly. Like I was trying to tell them what had happened, but I was also trying to put together what had happened.
We went to a corporate dinner and I went to the bar tonight,
mm-hmm.
talked to a guy. And all of a sudden, I have no idea what has happened.
You feel like you've been poisoned or you need to go to the hospital or something? What? You want to go to the hospital and get checked out?
I don't know what has happened.
There was a wine glass by the TV. And I just remember that one officer like kind of pointed to it and saying something like, oh, been partying tonight.
I understand that you've been drinking tonight.
Excuse me?
Listen to me. Just listen to me. Nobody's accusing you of anything.
I've been drinking tonight. No.
It was wine, and right away he was like, oh, yeah, you've had a lot to drink.
Listen to me.
I actually hadn't had that much to drink tonight.
Okay. All right. How much have you had to drink tonight?
Jen asks to talk to the female officer alone. In the hallway, Officer Wright talks to the other male cops and a hotel employee.
Problem we got, she's drunk. Stupid drunk. We get these a lot, too, in the hotels where people get probably have more than they should have and invite people back to their room, and then they say they got raped.
Wright tells them it sounds like it was consensual to a point. At the hospital, there were signs of violence. What Jen's medical records from that night document is disturbing. A nurse found multiple lacerations in her vagina. Jen says she later discovered that her tailbone was dislocated and her breast implant had ruptured. She also had a blood test that showed her blood alcohol content was over the legal limit for driving. The toxicology screen was not comprehensive enough to determine whether she'd been drugged. A year and a half later, Louisville Metro Police cleared Jen's case. Not by arrest, but by exception. Cases can be cleared by exception only when police have identified a suspect, they know where that person is, and they have probable cause to support arresting and prosecuting the suspect. But something exceptional beyond their control stops them. In Jen's case, that exceptional reason was the prosecutor. In Louisville, the police department, the LMPD, asks prosecutors whether they should arrest people suspected of rape. Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Christy Gray is a sex crimes prosecutor in Jefferson County.
The difference, I think, between LMPD and a lot of jurisdictions is the sex crimes unit contacts our office about almost all of their cases, whereas a lot of jurisdictions, the police will only bring cases that they think are viable or that they've gotten to a certain level in the investigation.
We found the police often bring those cases to prosecutors early in the process, before they've done much investigating. And often, prosecutors tell police they don't intend to take the case to court, so police don't make an arrest. In Louisville, in 2017, only 15% of rape cases ended in an arrest. Research shows the national average is around 25%.
Essentially, it all comes down to whether or not, as a prosecutor, I believe that the evidence supports our burden, which is beyond a reasonable doubt.
It's not unusual for police and prosecutors to work closely on complicated cases. But rape is the only crime Louisville police handle this way. Less than 2% of all crimes reported in 2017 were cleared by exception because a prosecutor declined to take the case. But more than 40% of rape cases ended that way. Gray said the main reason they decline rape cases is because they're honoring a victim's wishes.
In a number of cases where we have a named suspect, the victim has said, I want the investigation closed. And so we'll screen the case and decline prosecution, mainly at the request of the victim.
The other main reason is that they don't think there's enough evidence to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt in court. I looked at the investigative record for every rape reported to Louisville police in 2017 and case files for more than two dozen. I asked Lieutenant Shannon Lauder, head of the Special Victims Unit, about the cases I looked at.
We have reviewed case files where only the victim was interviewed, the suspect was never interviewed, no other investigative efforts were sort of undertaken, and then the case was screened with the prosecutor.
I'm not going to allow you to act like my detectives are not thoroughly investigating cases because it's going to sound good for your article. That's reckless of you. It doesn't serve victims for you to say that, and I don't appreciate it. My detectives do a thorough job.
Surely, sometimes detectives do a thorough job, and sexual assault cases can be difficult to investigate. But we found cases that were screened with a prosecutor before almost any investigation had been done. I talked with Jonathan Kurland, an attorney advisor at an organization called Equitas. They help prosecutors get better at handling sexual violence cases. Kurland didn't comment on Louisville specifically, but he said prosecutors set the standard for what cases they'll take. And sometimes they set that bar too high.
So then that gets transmitted through other disciplines working sexual violence cases. And if they don't think the prosecutor's going to approve it, they don't exert the effort in maybe fully investigating it.
Detectives know they're going to have to get these cases past the prosecutor. Even a patrol officer, like Jeremy Wright. On the night he was called to Jen Sonato's hotel room, you can hear Wright speculating about whether the case will be strong enough.
That's one of the biggest hurdles we gotta deal with. One, there's no video. Two, she's drunk. So we don't know how much we can believe that out of her.
One, there's no video. Two, she's drunk. So we don't know how much we can believe out of her. Jen picked up on his skepticism that night. Here's what she told the female officer when they were alone.
He's already like, yeah, we don't believe you.
No, that's not
like,
how
I'm
it
like
is.
No. Like, come on.
Louisville police spokesperson Jesse Halliday said Wright didn't overstep that night because he still did everything he was supposed to. He called for sex crimes detectives and he got the victim to the hospital. But his approach had an effect on Jen. She didn't want to meet with the male detective that came to the hospital where she was getting a rape kit exam. Louisville police say Jen did meet with the detective, but that she told him she didn't want an investigation. Jen strongly disputes that claim. But because she didn't formally report, police didn't interview the bartenders. They didn't try to find the guy she accused to get his side of the story that night. They didn't gather any evidence. Not the bloody sheets, not the wine glass, not the orange lighter Jen said the man left behind in her room. From that first night, her case seemed destined to be declined by a prosecutor for a lack of evidence. But unlike several cases I reviewed, Jen Sonato's case did include a phone call to the suspect, the man she shared a drink with at the hotel bar.
My name is Lindsay Lynch. I'm a detective with Louisville Metro Police Department.
I got the audio of this phone call from Jen's lawyer, who got it through a subpoena. In civil court, Jen is alleging that the hotel was negligent in overserving her and failing to investigate a noise complaint about her room, and that the man she says raped her committed battery and inflicted emotional distress that night. Through his lawyer, the man declined to comment and said he maintains the encounter was consensual. A lawyer for the Marriott did not return a request for comment. We aren't naming the man because he wasn't charged. That's also why you won't hear his voice during this call with Detective Lynch.
So, okay, there's a female named Jen Sonato who says that she met you at the hotel bar there. Do you remember this at all?
Detective Lynch made this call in July 2018, 7 months after Jen's initial police report. Up until this moment, this man had no idea he was the main suspect in a police investigation. Lynch tells him Jen has accused him of sexual assault. He insists nothing like that happened.
So I was hoping that you could tell me what did happen.
He confirms that he met Jen. He says she was very flirty, pursuing him. He says she seemed loopy, like maybe she was on medication. They had a few drinks at the hotel bar, and then went back to one of their rooms. He couldn't remember which, and he thinks they had sex. He says it was all consensual. So Detective Lynch floats a new theory.
I'm not positive that something didn't happen after she left your room.
He says that's what he was wondering, too. But of course, police never looked for any suspect that night. If there was another man, police didn't find him.
At this point, I don't really know. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. So I don't know that an attorney, one of our Commonwealth attorneys, do anything with it, because normally, especially in cases like this, we need something that proves that there was a crime. And I'm not sure that we have met that in this case.
There was limited physical evidence from the hotel because Jen was unwilling to talk to the detective after the way the patrol officers treated her. The police didn't do any other investigating that night. They never interviewed Jen's family members, who she first told about the assault over the phone that night, or the person staying in the next room who called in a noise complaint. And in their first phone call with the suspect, 7 months later, they apparently gather no new details worth following up on, because less than 24 hours later, Lynch is calling him back.
Okay, so I just got off the phone with the Commonwealth's attorney, Christy Gray, and she and I both are under the impression that we do not think that it is a good case.
He jumps in, "Oh my God, thank you." He tells Lynch he's been panicking all night and hired a lawyer. She tells him the Commonwealth's attorney only takes cases they can prove. This isn't one of them. Of 194 rapes reported to Louisville police in 2017, 30 ended with an arrest. Just 30. In many ways, those 30 cases fit popular stereotypes of rape. There's serious injury or a gun involved. The offender is a stranger or has a long history of domestic violence. There was an eyewitness or a confession.
What it says here is that on September 28th, 2017, that you strangled your girlfriend.
Her maternal uncle subjected her to sexual contact.
You then pulled down her pants and underwear.
He picked her up, threw her to the ground, and held her down and attempted to remove her pants.
The defendant stated that he would not leave until the two had sex.
These cases could have come with serious jail time. Each count of first-degree rape comes with a sentence of 10 to 20 years, or 20 to 50 years if the victim is under 12 or there's serious injury. But often, they didn't.
Judge Commonwealth will move to dismiss counts 1 and 3 in the indictment. Count 1 is rape in the first degree.
So the criminal attempt sodomy in the first degree has been dismissed.
The charge of rape 1 is going to be dismissed without prejudice.
Almost all of these cases ended with a plea deal. And in all but 4 cases, that plea came with the most serious charges dropped. That means out of 194 cases of rape reported, 30 led to an arrest. And only 4 of those ended in a conviction for rape. A plea deal isn't necessarily a bad thing. Some were made at the victim's request, and some were in exchange for serious jail time. Often, though, these deals came with suspended sentences or probation, which means the offender isn't in custody. But Louisville prosecutor Christy Gray says that's better than taking the case to trial and getting a not guilty verdict.
I think a lot of these people commit these offenses believing that they're going to get away with it. And if they do in the form of an acquittal, I think it makes them all the more dangerous.
Police and prosecutors here say screening rape cases before an arrest leads to stronger cases. But it's not leading to more rape convictions or more prison time. Only 10 of the people accused of rape in 2017 ended up serving any time for anything. What it is leading to is more rape victims being told that no one will ever be arrested in their case. During our interview, I talked to Jen Sonato about that.
And so eventually LMPD closed your case, right? Did they?
I'm hoping not.
Okay. No, I'm sorry.
I'm like...
LMPD had told Jen's lawyers on her civil suit that a prosecutor had declined the case. The lawyers thought Jen already knew, but she didn't. She found out when I told her.
It's very disappointing. Unbelievable. That is corrupt. That is, it doesn't make sense. So nothing now?
To clear a case by exception, Louisville police rules and FBI guidelines say they need probable cause to make an arrest. But Louisville police later told me they didn't have probable cause to make an arrest in Jen's case, but they cleared it by exception anyway. Rape is the most underreported crime in America. Federal statistics estimate less than a quarter of all sexual assaults were reported to police in 2018. LMPD spokesperson Jesse Halliday says if people don't feel comfortable reporting a rape, police and prosecutors aren't to blame. In fact, she thinks the fault lies with people like me, journalists.
The issues that make it difficult are that police are pitted as people who don't care and portrayed as people who don't care. And I think that is a big part of it. That stories like this will make it more difficult for women to come forward because they won't trust police, because cases like this are difficult to prosecute.
But long before I started reporting on this, Louisville's rate of reported rapes was already low, the fewest per capita among places that Louisville considers peer cities. Some similar-sized cities had more than twice as many rapes reported. That could mean Louisville has fewer rapists. Or it could mean more of them are getting away with it.
Thanks to Eleanor Klibanoff for bringing us that story. It's a part of the first season of Dig, a new podcast from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting and Louisville Public Media. When we come back, we look at the housing crisis in Silicon Valley. You're listening to Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson.
Estoy pensando cómo son varias compañías las que están en Apple y Google son las más principales. Y lo que yo estoy mirando es...
Selma Angeles is speaking at a community forum inside a small amphitheater in Mountain View, California, the heart of Silicon Valley. It's a busy weeknight. The former mayor of the city is here, and so is a representative from one of the area's largest landowners, Google. Selma is a single mother of four, and she has a question for tech giants like Google.
How
are they going to help us? How are they going to protect us?
Today, Selma lives near downtown San Jose. But in the past, she and her family have lived in a homeless shelter, someone's garage, even her car. So she knows how traumatic being displaced from your home can be, especially for kids.
Estoy pensando, ¿cómo nos van a ayudar como comunidad?
There's a lot of communities that have been displaced, and how are we going to help our children? For example, in my case, to help my children overcome the trauma that they had, how is these big tech companies going to help the community, and how are they going to help these families?
According to Zillow, the average house costs about $1 million in San Jose, about double what it was a decade ago. And as tech companies continue to grow, the housing market gets even tighter.
Since the recession, Silicon Valley has added just one new housing unit for every six new jobs that have located here. Unsustainable is what they say.
Unsustainable. But just how big a role does the tech industry play? Reveal teamed up with newsrooms in the San Francisco Bay Area to find out in a project called Who Owns Silicon Valley? After spending a year investigating, the Bay Area News Group, NBC Bay Area, KQED Public Radio, Renaissance Journalism, and Telemundo 48 uncovered the biggest landowners in the county. Stanford University was number one on the list, but four of the top 10 were giant tech companies, including Apple and Google.
You know, in Silicon Valley, property is power. That's the biggest asset, the biggest source of wealth. But it's also, property is also very scarce.
Marisa Kendall was a reporter on the project with the Bay Area News Group.
So another way to look at it is potentially these are some of the companies that have the biggest opportunity to contribute to building housing in the area. They have the land and they have the deep pockets.
But historically, not all tech companies have reached into those deep pockets.
Councilmember Wang?
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Steve is Steve Jobs, the late Apple CEO. It's 2011, and he's at a Cupertino City Council meeting to discuss plans for a new headquarters there, dubbed the Spaceship.
Quick question. I think people are curious as to know what this city residents can benefit from this new campus.
Well,
As you know, we're the largest taxpayer in Cupertino, so we'd like to continue to stay here and pay taxes. That's number one.
Okay.
He made it clear. Apple would not be offering any other help. Other large tech companies like Facebook and Google have had a slightly different approach. Earlier this year, both pledged $1 billion towards the housing shortage, and Google says it hopes to redevelop the area around its proposed new campus to include parks, bike paths, and 5,900 new homes. But they also want to add 25,000 new jobs, and that worries Selma. We called her after the forum. She's worried that more tech jobs will push rents even higher and force people like her out of their homes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the classic question, right, is how much is enough? There's some estimates that say we need 3.5 million new homes in California to fix our housing crisis.
Who ultimately bears responsibility for what's going on?
I think it depends who you talk to based off of the conversations we've been a part of through this process.
That's Sean Myers, a digital special projects producer at NBC Bay Area in San Jose, who also worked on the story.
You'll see that local governments will want to talk about the responsibility of big tech. Big tech will want to talk about the responsibility of local governments. And we've reached an impasse, I think it's safe to say. And it's important to remember that so much of this valley is single-family housing. Those people vote, they elect people. And if residents are apprehensive to new housing developments in their neighborhood, we're going to keep on seeing these struggles because nobody wants to budge.
But someone did budge. A week after the story broke, Apple promised to put $2.5 billion towards housing. Marisa says it's a sign of the times.
10 years ago, you never would have seen this, but the situation has gotten so desperate. Not only is there a lot of public pressure from housing advocates, but also these companies are having a really hard time hiring because their employees can't afford to live here either. So I think it just got to the point where these companies couldn't ignore it anymore.
I wonder if they sped up the announcement after it came out. Like, maybe they were planning on, like, well, give it another month or two, and then suddenly this comes out like, well, nope, we do it today.
I give Marisa credit for it, so.
I'm not going to dispute that.
Then I give Marisa credit for it as well. Thanks to KQED for providing us with audio from the community forum. We're always looking to team up with newsrooms. If you're a journalist who wants to work with Reveal, go to revealnews.org/local. Finally, today, I want to bring in my buddy, Byard Duncan. He's Reveal's engagement reporter. Hey, Byard.
Hey, Al.
All right, man. So every story in today's show grew out of some type of collaboration across newsrooms. You know, these type of collaborations have become pretty essential to journalism, in part because in many cities, local news is struggling.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Can I throw some stats at you real quick here?
Yeah, please do.
So the number of newsroom employees at U.S. newspapers fell by almost half between 2008 and 2018. And newspaper circulation in the U.S. has actually fallen every year for three decades. It fell 11% between 2016 and 2017 alone.
That is depressing. And obviously we know what that means for a lot of journalists, so they don't have jobs and that affects families, all of that. But what does it also mean for the larger public?
Well, I think it means that a lot of really important local stories aren't being told. And the thing about what we're doing right now is often we're telling these huge stories, these huge national stories that have a lot of local angles to them that end up just kind of getting lost in the mix because we have to sort of focus our reporting on a larger issue. And we started thinking a lot about this dynamic in 2018. We'd done a ton of reporting on rehabs that were forcing people to work for free in exchange for treatment. And we kept running into this big problem. We had too much stuff.
Too much stuff? What does that mean?
Documents, interviews, data. Plus, every time we released one of these stories, we'd hear from dozens of other people in other states telling us, you got to check out this rehab. So it quickly became clear that we basically had two options. Our reporters could spend the rest of their lives reporting on this issue, or we could figure out how to share what we had.
That's kind of how investigative reporting goes, right? You start with super wide lens, and then you have to narrow it down again and again and again.
Right. But in that process of narrowing, you end up having to cut out intriguing stuff, stuff that might not be important for your national story, but is nevertheless resonant to a local community in, say, Detroit or Seattle.
Sure. Exactly. So waste is bad. But how do you get all this stuff to local reporters?
Yeah, that became the challenge. So It differs each time we do a major investigation. We started building these things. We call them Reveals Reporting Networks back in July of 2018. And now we do it basically with every single investigation we put out. We find different ways to offer up the tips or the data or other stuff that accompanies the investigation that maybe we mention, but we actually don't really dig into in the story.
So anyone can join?
Yeah, and at the moment, we have six of these networks going. So you can get access to data about rape clearance rates, like we heard in Kentucky. You can get info on school concussions, like we heard about in Colorado. There's one about visas for immigrants and more.
So if you're a journalist in a local community and you want to get involved, all you have to do is go to revealnews.org/network. It's free. Thanks, Bart, for coming in.
Thanks, Al.
Thanks to all our partners on this week's show, KUNC Public Radio in Colorado, the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, and Louisville Public Media. Be sure to check out their new podcast, Dig. Today's show couldn't have been possible without our talented staff, including Najib Amini, Sumi Agarwal, Bayer Duncan, Catherine Miskowski, Diana Montano, Andy Donahue, Vivi Nguyen, Hannah Young, Robert Rosie Rosenthal, and Jen Sheehan. Plus our former colleagues, Michael Corey, Ziva Brandstetter, and Amy Pyle. And thanks to editors Emily Harris, Catherine Winter, and Kate Howard. Our production manager is Mwende Inahosa. Our sound design team is the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Amy Mustafa. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Matt Thompson is our editor-in-chief, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson. And remember, there is always more to the story.